part of the problem is English terminology, or for that matter, in any European languages, the Buddhist terminology is not fully settled yet. So there are various terms being used for different terms. And even in the Tibetan terms, we have one term called Derpa, which is generally translated as desire. And desire is a much broader term, which includes both a positive and negative and grasping and all the rest. Then we have another term called Chakpa, which is generally translated as attachment. And it's defined as
emotion.
And it's part of an afflictive emotion. Yes. But even then, sometimes you do find the same term used in a positive context as referring to a powerful, forceful compassion. For example, sometimes you attribute that quality to the Buddha of compassion and says that he has attachment. He is attached to the sentient beings.
To all sentient beings.
To all sentient beings. So the term may be used in one way dominantly, but it can also be used in a different way.
Yes. So you understand what I want to do is just be free to use the word attachment as a positive thing when it's secure for today. No,
To what extent would you equate that with like trust or confidence?
That'll present a little bit of problem later, but it's fine. Okay. If we can talk, the second point here, the reason Bowlby used the word attachment was that he wanted to somehow indicate that the bond was specific to that person. So if it's a stranger, even a nice stranger, the child doesn't get the same sense of security as from the familiar, loving mother. So he's saying in a way, the child is frightened, the child is looking for this person, and that'll be important to the experiments with adults I'm going to do. And so I don't think he would have necessarily defended the word. He just in thinking about what is he going to call?
Well, it makes perfect sense.
Having a relationship partner that is a specific person, and he called it attachment. This is what Mathieu told me, that it could be called reliance, sort of a dependable reliance on that person.
Lodzhe Chuse was saying that one probable term in Tibetan could be this object of attachment, and you're talking about the object of secure attachment. Could be Lodzhe Chuse, which literally means that in which you entrust your hope.
As you'll see in my last slide, the connection of Buddhism, when I see someone say, I take refuge in the Buddha, that taking refuge is what this means. Okay, so then I have one slide here just to try to summarize the theory. The theory on the right there is a monkey mother. I don't know if you can see the baby is holding on to it underneath, and then a human mother and daughter photographed by Fountain. And the first point about the theory is that the way we are built biologically as humans, as an extension of Michael's rats and not so far an extension from those rhesus monkeys, just the way we're constructed is that when we're frightened, to look for, Bowlby called this feature of the attachment person, a safe haven. So we're looking for a place of safety, and we're looking for that person to be that. He also, another idea I have to describe just briefly, is that he was taking his ideas from biological studies of other primates, of monkeys. And so he used the concept from biology of a behavioral system, some set of emotions and directed behavior that clearly has a function, in this case, saving the infant from danger. And it's important because he divided the person's motivation into attachment, exploration, that's the curiosity part, caregiving, which is the compassion part, and sex, things like that. So there's a set of other behavioral systems. And an important idea from Ainsworth's work is that the way these behavioral systems seem to be organized in the mind is that if you're threatened, you're looking first for protection and all the other ones are inhibited. As soon as you feel secure and it looks to you like you are protected, then you don't sit around hanging on to attachment for those moments. You then are curious, caring, humorous, playful, all of those kinds of things. So this back and forth relationship of one behavioral system inhibiting another is important.
Inhibits the goba.
In our experiments, what we want to do is make the person more secure so this grasping for security will go down, and then we'll see if compassion becomes stronger. You know, so this is my intuition about a kind of Buddhist idea that if you can get yourself and your mind completely relaxed and not defending this false self, you'll be naturally loving. You would also be naturally curious. It would sort of matter a little bit what's out here to do. So then the only other thing I need to say right now about the theory itself is that what Ainsworth observed in studying these mother-infant relationships is that she saw three different patterns of infant attachment. One is secure, and I'll say a little bit more about what that looks like in a minute. Another one she called anxious. That's this grasping, uncertain, frightened kind of pattern. And the other one, avoidant, I'll also say more about, but is sort of defensively being hurt in this process and then deciding I'm not going to rely on anybody. And both of those are those insecure patterns are important psychologically. Okay, so here the attachment behavioral system, as Bowlby called it, this is a diagram of what seems to go on. It seems like the mind is built, and now I'm talking about the mind of a human infant, is built to be noticing whether there is an attachment figure, as Bowlby called it, a person like mother, near, paying attention, sensitive and responsive. And if the answer is perceived to be yes, the child feels a set of emotions, and I don't know what to call them exactly, but feels loved, feels more secure, confident, and so on. And then what you see in behavior, in the child's behavior, is they naturally explore, they become more playful and happier, they smile more. You can code all of this on videotapes and just see that this is what's happening. So an idea of the theory is that if all of us were going around all the time feeling we had a positive answer to that question, we would stay in this happy loop all the time. We would check every once in a while, make sure it's still okay, she's still there for me, and then life would continue to be good. For all of us, there are times when we perceive the answer to be no. Either she's not paying attention, she has left the room, you're with a babysitter that you don't know, and all of those things. Then, Bowlby's idea was a set of afflictive emotions will arise automatically, and the natural part of it would be anxiety that then triggers a set of behaviors designed biologically to get back in contact, get a yes answer to the question. Then that's this anxious pattern, crying, demanding, all of those kinds of things, being frightened. In the human case, it's interesting because Michael was talking about the stress response in those infant rats that then grow up to be anxious. All of that, everything I've said so far, I think, is the human version of that same thing. In humans, there's this odd possibility of defending against the pain of not getting a yes answer. And what seems to happen, this is a part of the theory that is like psychoanalysis, and Bowlby was a psychoanalyst. You can become, in your mind, you can build some kind of inhibition on the whole system. And the child begins to not cry very much. When the mother leaves the room, they act like they don't care. They keep messing with the toys and things like that. If you measure the baby's heart rate, it goes up when she goes out of the room, but it doesn't cry or go toward her. And that's called avoidant. That pattern is viewed as a defensive pattern. In an infancy, you can't completely avoid your mother. With a baby, that you can't be so avoidant that you leave home because you absolutely need your mother to feed you, protect you, and things like that. So the avoidance is mostly in the mind. It's sort of, I'm not going to reach out and show that I need things. And as I'll explain in a minute, the parents of that kind of child have sort of indicated they don't want this signs of vulnerability and need. They want the child to be strong, more distant and self-contained and so on. So to summarize this part, the personality part, what happens is if you experience mostly that positive thing, and in a minute I'm going to use you as an example that's true of. If your mother is nice to you repeatedly, and lets you sit at the head of the table and, you know, takes your needs into account, that the research shows that the person becomes more confident, you know, more relaxed, less stress response, all of those kinds of things Michael was talking about. If the person is sometimes there for you and sometimes not, in a very unpredictable way, you get this heightened anxiety that after a while becomes characteristic of the person's nervous system. And if the child continually is rewarded for being avoidant, you get someone who begins to hold their emotions in, not ask for help, and things like that. And it sort of persists. Not that it can't change. I'm going to explain how it can change. Sorry. What about these? What's known about those three patterns?
Phil, just out of curiosity, by what age the patterns are?
You can measure this reliably starting at age one. So a lot of it is happening in the first year of life. And then if that whole parenting style continues, it becomes more solidified over time. But it can change. That's one of the things I want to show you, is that when we experimentally increase a person's security, they show that they've absorbed the change, that they can change. What Ainsworth and her students found over the years is that if you go into these children's homes, the ones who look secure in that strange situation laboratory test, and you look over the months at what's going on there, the child is confident that there'll be someone there because there usually is. So in other words, you can look at the situation and document that the child is secure primarily because somebody has been sensitive, interested, appropriately responsive. And an interesting thing is that these children, after a while, and again, similar to what Michael is saying, they're easier to comfort, they're easier to soothe. If they become upset, as soon as they see that someone is going to take care of them, they relax quickly. So there's a whole experience built up with, yes, you want to express your needs, but usually when you express them, then you can calm down, everything will be better. And those children by age three already are more empathic, you know, more sort of play creatively. So the way their mind is being structured over time shows in this whole range of things. So in the theory, we believe that sensitive, empathic parenting and preschool teachers, you know, other relatives, that kind of experience for the child is going to make them more confident, less stress prone, and all of those good things. The anxious child seems to come about because, and usually these studies were done when mother was clearly the primary parent. Father was working and not paying attention. So most of it is, I'm apologizing for using the word mother. I'm a father who's tried to do half of the work in our house, so it bothers me when it's called mother, but let's call it mother for the moment. This kind of child has a mother who is anxious herself, and her anxiety causes her to be self-preoccupied. And you can see when you observe the interaction at home that it results in poorly coordinated care for the baby. Sometimes too, you know, intrusive, too much, feeding them when they're not really wanting to be fed, but sometimes being neglectful just because they're worried about themselves. And to jump ahead, I'll show you in our experiments adults like that. If we show them someone suffering, instead of helping, the effect it has on them is, wow, it makes me nervous to see someone suffer. Not that I'll help, you know, that my attention is on me. And that kind of parenting makes the child anxious, it seems, partly because it isn't possible to relax if you don't know whether your safe haven will be there for you or not. The avoidant child, at the worst, has an abusive parent, but in Ainsworth's studies, there wasn't anyone like that. She was using a fairly normal group of families. And what seems to happen there is that the parent either doesn't like physical contact with a child. They don't want someone slobbering on their clothes and things like that. So they have a whole set of mostly nonverbal mechanisms, and it includes not talking to them. You know, this thing we were saying, something that's probably going to have cognitive effect. So to make that connection between the parent's mental state and behavior and the child's, it is possible now to give an interview called the Adult Attachment Interview, or AAI for short. It's about a one-hour discussion with a person about their childhood experiences with their caregivers. And this interview is tape recorded and then coded systematically. And what happens basically is when the child is...
Can you explain what's coded?
Yeah, so you listen to the interview and there's a little score sheet that's been designed by researchers. And if you see certain kinds of things happening in the interview, you put up, say, a check mark, okay? Then in the end, you could give a number to that person. How avoidant, how anxious, how secure. The really interesting, and to me shocking, I didn't believe this when it first happened, is the research is due to someone named Mary Main at Berkeley. It seemed impossible for this kind of sort of soft measure to do this well, but now there are 15 or so studies like this. If you classify the adult parents' discussion of their childhood experiences into secure, avoidant, anxious qualities about that person, the way they're describing what happened to them, you can predict with 70% accuracy how their child will be classified in Ainsworth's strange situation. And the form of the connection is avoidant mother, avoidant child in the strange situation. Anxious mother, anxious child, secure, secure. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but it's very close to that. What this means from a point of view of clinical, you know, application.
He's always wondering, but given that there are two parents.
Yes, yeah.
The effect of other parent on the, so yes, in terms of the temperament of the child.
Of course, that's a great question. If at age one, this interview with each parent predicts the way the child acts in the strange situation with that parent, even if it requires the child to be different with the two of them, that's really important because it shows that this child is capable of adapting to whatever parenting structure it encounters.
So just out of curiosity, Solens was asking, from the genetics point of view, the transfer, right, there is no difference.
Yeah, you're right. That's my next point. There have now been behavior genetic studies of twins where you try to figure out how much of this patterning is due to genes and how much to the social environment. And so far, there's no evidence for it being genetically based. That's another. I'm skeptical about that because this high stress reactivity, although I know I was interested to see in Michael's talk that when you cross-foster them, they seem adaptable in that sense too. In his studies, you take this infant and put it over here with a different mother, and then it shows the pattern of that new mother, even though they're not genetically linked.
Environment.
Yeah, so it shows the tremendous importance of environment.
Absolutely. And it showed this 70% connection shows how important it would be to intervene with the parent, which is something that Helen was saying, you know, for more cognitive issues too. If you could change the parenting structure, then there's good evidence that I'll show you. There are 70 studies like that now, almost all very recent, showing that you can intervene successfully and change it.
I was just suggesting also, so that we don't start to make an absolute distinction between genes and environment, that this type of parenting can also influence genetic expression, as you were talking about, presumably.
Yep. Yeah. So the bottom line here is that we know now from I hate to use the word, but meta-analysis, there's a review of all the studies of intervention, and it concludes very strongly that intervention works. And sometimes the interventions are fairly simple that work. One of them is to work with the parent, show them a diagram. It's called the circle of security, and it sort of explains that every child is set up so that if you comfort them and you pay attention to them, sense of thing, they will then go out to explore. And for the anxiously inclined parent, you have to explain that when they go out, let them go out. You know, don't interfere with them. That's one of the things that bothers them. And then once they're out there playing, it's also natural, biologically natural, them to look back once in a while to see if you care. And they might even come over and show you, you know, the toy. Then you have to interact with, you have to talk to them. Yes, this is, you know, this is like your telephone at home. And then, you know, pay attention to the thing. Then they go out. Then they come back. And just showing them videotapes of their interactions with their child in connection with that little diagram noticeably improves the security of the children. So I wanted to give an example of something that would be scored as secure, this coding I was talking about, in the...
In the parenting on the part of the mother, of course, there's a lot of variability. Some mothers are able to, you know, of course, love their child, but also allow the child to be a lot freer and play around and so on. Others, out of very strong attachment and you know, sort of love, always worried that the child may get hurt by doing this or that, so constantly sort of, you know, checks the child. So
put some restrictions.
Sometimes put some restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Against the wish of the child.
Yes.
So his Holiness is wondering, on the part of the child, at what age will they come to understand why these restrictions are being put?
Uh-huh.
Out of compassion, out of concern.
That, yes. That the mother is doing it out of love.
Yes. Well, first of all, that's a very... It would take a long time. I mean, this is something we could discuss this afternoon, but... Generally, if the mother is looking fearful and transmitting that to the child, this is an example of what I'm saying. If really what she's saying is, I'm scared that you'll be hurt, and it's about me, that's the kind of thing that makes the child become anxious, because their safe haven and secure base.
Take this up in the
afternoon. Yeah. So then it's important, though, that I don't want to imply that I think, you know, restrictions are bad. What happens in these secure relationships is that in talking to the child, that part of this good relationship is the 2-year-old is there and you just gently explain. It's great for you to play. You know, I love it when you do this thing. That you want to do this and that's fine. But there are, you know, I also don't want you to be hurt, and so I sort of want you to understand this. And what happens is, over time, if that's done sensitively, the child sort of absorbs, they understand that this is in their interest. A 2 or 3-year-old definitely can understand that. Not that they'll always do everything that parents want, but the idea is, this is another place where talking to them that Helen was talking about, that the good parent in this theory, and this has been well demonstrated, says, in effect, I know how you feel. You like to, you know, you like to hang out over the edge of the mountain, and it's exciting, and it's interesting. So it's sort of saying, I recognize your feelings, and that's okay. You know, those feelings are okay. But we want to make sure that, you know, you gradually learn that your feelings don't lead you to fall off the mountain. And it's the... It's this discussion about feelings. By age 3 or 4, that those kids are more sophisticated in talking about their feelings and in recognizing other people's. They show increased empathy because, you know, someone has been telling us, we all have feelings. We're being we have motives. So the restrictions are okay if they are sensitive in the first place, that they're sensible, and that they're communicated sensibly to the child. And I'm not talking about any one incident, because I hope it's okay if you're not always the optimal parent. I certainly have. But generally, the kid is generalizing from thousands of interactions. And if most of them have this sensitive, you know, it's your interests that I have in mind, if that's convincing. So here's just to give an example, I want to convey a little bit better how this looks in an interview. And here's quotations from a real person. My mother was undoubtedly one of the kindest people I've ever known. She was truly wonderful and was loved, I'm quite certain, by all who knew her. She was very compassionate. Now, that kind of thing appearing in this hour-long interview, if they convincingly say that, which he does in this case, that's an indication of security that then is transmitted by you to your students and so on, to us.
So this was saying that that's his.
Yeah. So then here's another example. There were two consolations to life at the monastery.
That is right, what I mean.
Yeah.
Someone was saying that you cannot rely too much.
Yeah. This is why you need two of you, so you have two parents. One of them can relax for a while. There were two consolations to life at the monastery. First, my immediate brother, Lobsang Samten, was already there. He took good care of me. And this, I put ... because the passage is longer than that. But you see again, the environment changed in a way that could be frightening to a child. And another good person, besides mom, who also moved there, he's given a sense of secure, you know, a safe haven, a secure base. And then this is very interesting because it's another sign. Once you begin life this way, I know in our questionnaires we have a question where you say, how much do you agree that people are generally well-intentioned and kind-hearted? Mm-hmm. And these people believe that. And the ones who've been treated unreliably and, you know, or abusively, just in their heart of hearts, they can't believe that. It has not been true in their experience. So then this, I think, is a sign, too, of being able to find refuge. The second, there was a very kind old monk who often held me inside his gown. This is remembered over a 50-year period. And on one occasion, I recall, he gave me a peach. So if you think of a memory, you know, I mean, that's the way I do think of long-term memory. It's loaded with thousands of these experiences. If the ones that come to you spontaneously are of kindness generally, that's the secret of this whole thing. And it doesn't mean that one of the reasons I'm showing this is not just this happy side. But here's another example from the same autobiography of a painful memory, and it's very important in scoring this adult attachment interview that the person can access pain. There is no person who doesn't have any painful experiences, and it's an avoidant characteristic not to be able to retrieve them. So in the same account, you know, just sort of freely remembering back to childhood over 50 years, a painful memory, one of my uncles, a monk, one evening he's reading his prayers, and His Holiness upsets the guy's scripture book, a loose-leaf book. The pages fly over, and he picked me up and slapped me hard. So there's a memory of a single instance over 50 years. And even though that's a negative emotional experience, to be able to recall that freely is extremely important. It implies, you know, not having defensively walled off those experiences. And in fact, this would take a long time to explain, but an avoidant person in the adult attachment interview often has a hard time remembering anything. And when they do remember things, they often give positive memories that they can't justify. So that you said she was nice, you know, about your mother. What does that mean? And the person will say, you know, she was a mother. And a secure memory instead says, wham. I'll give you an example. So I reveal the secret of who this interviewee is. It's a beautiful book, by the way. So now I can get on to our own. So all of that research was done about children and was the inspiration for ours. In 1987, one of my students and I, for a reason I won't go into, were thinking we would apply those three patterns in research with young adults. And so we wrote a questionnaire measure, and this is it. In the beginning, it's very simple, just like this. And we, by interviewing people and reading the literature about the baby studies and so on, we created these descriptions. The avoidant one is like this. And this was first about romantic relationships, but now we know it doesn't have to be romantic. So it sounds a little romantic, and that's because that's what we were studying. I'm uncomfortable being close to others. I find it difficult to trust them completely, difficult to allow myself to depend on them. I'm nervous when anyone gets too close, and relationship partners often want me to be more intimate than I feel comfortable being. That characterizes about 25% of American college students and young, and adults in the community, too, the ones I've studied are mostly young. And that's about how many avoidant babies there are in these U.S. studies of that same middle-class strata of society. So what we do is ask the person, we show these three to a person and ask them to say which, if they think about their close relationships, which one of those is most like them. And in the beginning, that's a sort of rough way to do research, but it actually was very revealing even with that that loose a measure. The anxious pattern, just so that what I want to do is build up an understanding, a loose understanding of what these patterns are like. And then when we get to the experiments where we change them, you sort of know what's under there that's changing. The anxious pattern is like this. Relationship partners, their loved ones, are reluctant to get as close as I would like. So this kind of person wants, they're insecure. They want more security. I often worry that my partner doesn't really love me or won't want to stay with me. I want to get very close to my partner, and this sometimes scares people away. They've had in this grasping, they often then get rejected because nobody wants to be suffocated by that. So they're able. This reminds me of my continuing conversation with Alan. Here's an example. It's amateurish, but I'm clearly taking the subjective side. This is the way they experience things. And then the secure one in this measure, we just say, I find it relatively easy to get close to others. I'm comfortable depending on them. I don't often worry about being abandoned or about somebody being too close. And what you see there is about 20% of young adult Americans are check that anxious style, and a slight majority check the secure one. And this is also true of baby studies using Ainsworth's strange situation assessment. So over time, we found out, that was 1987, that we could think about this in a more refined way, and we could measure it in a more refined way. So then I need to just explain this briefly. The way we do it now is with two self-report sets of questions, and I'll show them to you in a minute. And there we have one about anxiety and one about avoidance, those two dimensions. And the scores are continuous, so they run like from one to some high number. And so we think of the person, if you measure the same person over time, their scores move around a little bit for various reasons, depending on how they're feeling at the time and plus error of the of measurement. So we think of a person as being at a region of this two-dimensional space. So the way we put the person in that two-dimensional space is with items like this, and we ask the person filling out a questionnaire to say, how much do you agree this is like you or not? Those are examples of the avoidance items. And where it says reverse scored, it means that we flip the scale numbers around before averaging them. So when you do this, we have 18 items about this, and we have 18 about anxiety. Those are some examples. You can get a highly reliable score for the person that is likely to be repeated over time and so on. So after a person answers those, we get their scale numbers, we average them to see how anxious and how avoidant. We can then place them in this two-dimensional space. Sure. And that's what we do in a lot of our studies to get at that thing. So now some just longitudinal studies are ones where one person is studied over time, whether people like some children.
No. 차면 늦어졌다. 측면
늦어졌다.
측면 늦어졌다. 자왔다. 야, 지당 자와 줘라.
그래.
지. 디 유는 이렇게 하면 yes. 땜마디 캐메로 도나게 도나게 그 심지 샤이
It's only wondering.
The Chagat Zawadi, Pajog, Namdu, Sang, Timbuji, you under that. Younger one. That was Jidang and Zawako, Pajiji, using his wish to come to energy.
Has any study been done on trying to determine the differences of the characteristics between sexual attachment or love and kind of, you know, general attachment and love?
Yes.
Because the sexual, one would expect that the sexual attachment, that type of love, would be quite contingent upon the perception of characteristics of that individual, physical particularly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. The, so the
attachment is a sixth chibusuwardi kungodliya peji shukch kebaji shumbuji menuadi.
Because we use the same term attachment in your context.
Yeah, yeah.
There could be sexual as you know, as opposed to. So, Holiness is wondering whether there is any differentiation of that by the...
Yes. When we're studying this as romantic relationships, mm-hmm. then sexual attraction is part of how the two people get together.
He's wondering, and also he, you know, occasionally brings this up. You can see the phenomenon of love and hate in a romantic relationship where there is a sexual element involved.
Yes.
But can one also see the same thing, say, between a parent and child?
Yes. And remember, the concepts came from a parent-child relationship. So it's more that I think of the some of the issues in a relationship between sexual partners are these same issues. And I know that because we have studied that. But there are additional ones. There's then attractiveness, sex, how they feel about sex, per se, religious training about sex. So it's more complicated. But, yeah, just to give you an example, the people who score high on that avoidance scale, and so all they said on the questions is they don't like to be too close, they don't like anyone, they don't want to share their feelings, things like that. They have more sexual partners, more one, we call it in the United States, one night stands. Sexual experience.
Is
it because they attract more partners? Or
They're interested in sex, but not intimacy.
And they show.
In that.
Yeah.